Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with writers in the studios of North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
My guest today says that for some problems, cognitive behavioral therapy is an effective alternative to medication. Joel Minden is a clinical psychologist who specializes in cognitive behavioral therapy for anxiety. He says anxiety can be distracting, annoying, even frightening, but if we give ourselves the chance to respond to it with reason and acceptance, we're likely to learn that anxiety can be tolerable and harmless. Joel Minden is an adjunct lecturer in the Department of Psychology at California State University, Chico, and has written a guide to reducing anxious thoughts and worry. The title of his book is Show Your Anxiety Who's Boss. Joel Minden, welcome.
Thank you, Nancy. Thanks for having me.
Now, you teach at Chico State University, and you teach a course in sport and exercise psychology. I wanted to ask you about that because I would think that would draw a good bit of interest.
I haven't taught that course in a while. I used to do a seminar on sport and exercise psychology. And yeah, I think it's very interesting to people. And of course, in sports psychology, sometimes people are very interested in kind of improving performance. But I think there's also a clinical side to sports psychology where athletes who might be struggling with emotional distress, some sort of psychological disturbance, sometimes it's really helpful to understand the unique experience of athletes when you're providing clinical services. So, lots to study in sports psychology, very interesting field. And hopefully in the future, I'll be teaching that again.
Well, I did notice that you're interested in athletes, performers, dancers, and so you help them out also, do you?
That's right. And personally, I have a dance background. I was a competitive ballroom dancer for a number of years. And so I just, you know, I'm really fascinated by the experience of dancers specifically, but all athletes. I just think it's so interesting to kind of explore the psychological aspect of sport performance.
Well, I once had a young woman in my college class who had a beautiful voice. Her father was a professional singer, but she would get so anxious that she could not sing. I would see her skin, she would just flush totally red. And I wish you could have helped her, Joel, because she was such a talented person. She could sing so beautifully, but she could not because of anxiety.
I hear stories like that a lot. It's just so sad. Some people with amazing talent, whether it's in a performance area or in sport, sometimes they just struggle so much with the experience of anxiety. It's so overwhelming for them that even with all of that talent, all that ability, it's really hard for them to work through that and kind of perform to an audience or competitively on the field. And it's just nice to know that people who maybe they struggle in terms of performance or their effectiveness because of anxiety, that it is a very treatable issue, and hopefully people will start to recognize more over time that there is a lot of help out there, a lot of things that can be done to help people deal with anxiety a little more effectively.
Well, what motivated you to write this book?
Well, that's a good question. I guess I have a number of reasons. I think, anxiety is just such a universal emotional experience for people. Everyone can relate to the challenge of anticipating that something bad will happen and that they won't be able to cope or manage their behavior effectively in a certain situation because of anxiety. And I think it's something that we all understand. We can all relate to it. And what I think is so wonderful about cognitive behavioral therapy is it's pretty straightforward. It's a logical approach, and using CBT to treat anxiety tends to have a very big impact. So personally, I find the work to be very rewarding because a lot of people are very responsive to some of the cognitive behavioral methods that we tend to use in treatment. So I think because it's just such a commonly experienced disorder or just maybe a commonly experienced emotional challenge for so many people. And because it is so treatable, you know, it's something that I really find rewarding to do that work in a clinical setting. And I also wanted to provide some sort of manual or self-help guide for people who don't have the opportunity to work with a therapist or people who want to use this as an adjunct to therapy, because I really believe that the tools that I have in this book, the concepts that are presented, I think they can be helpful for people who struggle with anxiety that takes all kinds of forms. So anyway, big picture, I'm really hoping that this book will be beneficial to a lot of people, especially, I guess one more thing I want to say is that so many people, when they do have a tough time with anxiety, they kind of have this idea that if they're going to get a handle on anxiety or an anxiety disorder, it involves reducing the intensity of the emotion. And I guess my perspective is quite different, that anxiety is a part of life. It is something that we all experience. So it's really important to learn how to accept it, how to work through it, and how to redirect your attention back to what you really want to be doing in the moment versus paying so much attention to anxiety itself and working so hard to try to reduce it. So that's another thing. I think that the approach that I promote or that I emphasize in the book, personally, I think it's pretty different from the messages or the ideas that a lot of people have about managing anxiety. So I really wanted to get that information out there to the public.
My guest is Joel Minden, and he has written a book, Show Your Anxiety Who's Boss, a 3-step CBT program to help you reduce anxious thoughts and worry. And on the cover of your book, you have those initials, CBT. And for someone unfamiliar, they have to open up the book and find out what that is. Mm-hmm. So if you use cognitive behavioral therapy as your primary way of helping somebody, what are the alternatives? Because I have several friends who are psychotherapists and psychologists, and they tend to use this same way, but there are other counseling systems.
Mm-hmm. There are so many different theoretical orientations, different ways that therapists or other professionals might approach certain types of problems. So, you know, I guess in a nutshell, I'll start with just a short explanation of CBT. Cognitive behavioral therapy. Cognitive, we think about or we consider how people think. Behavioral, but what people do. And when we look at the interplay, the relationships among thoughts, behaviors, and emotions, you see some pretty clear, predictable patterns. And so what I like about CBT as an approach is that it helps people recognize that they can attend to their thoughts and perhaps modify them if their thinking tends to be biased, if they exaggerate the degree of threat, or they underestimate their ability to cope. So a lot of opportunities to work with kind of biased, distorted, negative patterns of thinking to maybe adjust them or at least respond to them with ideas that are more realistic and useful. And then, you know, the behavioral element is so important that I think a lot of people, when they have a tough time with anxiety, they run into problems of avoidance. They really distance themselves from situations that might normally be really fulfilling, important, but because they're so concerned about the experience of anxiety, they pull away, they distance themselves. And as a result, anxiety becomes a bigger problem for them, and they're not really giving themselves an opportunity to, you know, to do the things that make life meaningful, that give us a sense of purpose and fulfillment. So the behavioral element really involves taking action and taking those steps to work toward important challenges, despite the fact that anxiety may come along for the ride. So in a nutshell, those are, you know, some, I guess, key elements of CBT as a treatment. And you were asking about other approaches. I know sometimes people contact me, they're interested in psychotherapy, and they tell me that they've gone to other therapists before. And sometimes I'll hear things like, you know, the focus is really just sort of exploring what happened over the course of the week or what's been difficult and venting and getting emotional support. And I think that's wonderful in therapy. I think that should be present in all forms of therapy. But when it comes to addressing anxiety concerns specifically, that approach might feel nice, but I think typically people don't make a lot of progress. They don't learn how to address anxiety. They just learn to kind of express that they're dealing with it, and it's tough and it has a big impact on their lives. I think another thing that tends to happen a lot in therapy is people kind of explore their, with the help of the therapist, they explore their personal history. And so maybe they kind of reflect on early experiences, maybe in childhood where anxiety really created some problems for them, or maybe they observed anxiety or anxious patterns of behavior in parents or other family members. And that type of developmental experience can really, you know, shape how people understand anxiety and relate to it over the lifespan. So some therapists, they're really focused on the developmental experiences, the personal history that might explain why somebody has a problem with anxiety currently. So, you know, I guess a lot of therapists will say that their approach is pretty eclectic and they kind of dabble in different styles or orientations. But personally, I think that there are a lot of common elements across the different psychotherapies. But I think what makes CBT maybe different, or in my opinion, more effective for anxiety related concerns, is it's change oriented. We really focus on how can people identify some of the things that they're doing now, maybe bias patterns of thinking or destructive patterns of behavior, avoidance, and how can they change? What can they do differently that might help them relate differently to anxiety and work through it and kind of get on with doing those things that are so valuable in life. So that personally, that's why I find CBT to be so useful. I think generally people respond pretty quickly, and I think the impact is pretty significant. And, you know, when people see the dramatic shift in their ability to take on anxiety-provoking challenges that perhaps previously they really struggled with, it's so empowering, it feels so good. And so I think very rewarding for the client, and certainly rewarding for me to see people make those meaningful changes.
I'll be back with author and clinical psychologist Joe Menden after a break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest today has written a book to help you deal with anxiety. It's a self-help program, a three-step program using cognitive behavioral therapy. Joe, when I was reading your chapter on or your example of mindfulness acceptance exercise, you describe a mindfulness acceptance exercise, and it starts out like a stress reduction program. For example, Enloe Medical Center has a mindfulness-based stress reduction program, and I used to help with that program. So I'm familiar with it. It starts out very similar to your mindful acceptance exercise. But it sounds like you then say, yeah, well, don't just sit there and meditate. Let's now do something. Is that accurate?
Yeah. You bring up a lot of great questions, Sarah, you know, important things to consider. you know, first of all, this idea of meditation, I find that the clients that I work with, they vary so much in their openness to explore meditation. Personally, I think meditation is sort of a means to an end for most people, that it helps them become a better observer of the inner experience. It makes it a little easier to attend to certain thoughts and feeling labels and physical sensations and urges or impulses, so that once those inner experiences are identified, it becomes a little easier to create some space and distance from what's going on inside. So then the individual can make a choice about how to proceed. So I'll give you an example. Let's say somebody is feeling very anxious about going to some sort of social event, going to a party or a family dinner or something like that. And they have a lot of anxiety. They're concerned that it won't go well, that people are going to judge them, that they'll be overwhelmed by the anxiety and they want to have a good time and things like that. So in a scenario like that, sometimes when people are so anxious, they just kind of very quickly respond to the anxiety or the awareness of anxiety by saying, I'm not going to go, I don't want to do this, it's just too uncomfortable. And so they make that choice to avoid. And as I said earlier, that creates long-term problems. So when people are more mindful, when they have the capacity to pay attention to the inner experience, they might recognize that, well, you know, the only thing that I'm really dealing with here is a lot of internal arousal, that physically, you know, I'm feeling pretty wound up, that I notice my heart's beating fast or I'm starting to sweat. But other than that, you know, there's nothing else that's really difficult about this. I'm not concerned about anything in particular. It's just kind of the uncertainty of the situation is challenging. And so maybe in that case, the individual might say, well, you know, this is just a physical response because there are a lot of unknowns here. I can tolerate that. And I'm going to make the choice in this moment to accept that invitation and go to this social event. So getting back to the issue of meditation and why we do it, my view is that meditation helps you attend to the inner experience. It helps you become a better observer, a non-judgmental observer of what's going inside, so that later you can make that call about what to do. Some people, when they engage in a meditation practice, they think that what they're really going for is stress reduction, and certainly that's maybe one reason that you know, somebody might turn to meditation if they're dealing with a lot of stress. And I think there are certain practices associated with meditation that might help with stress reduction. But for me, you know, when I recommend this mindful acceptance practice, which is, you know, arguably very similar to meditation, it's much more about observing the inner experience. And sometimes there will be a lot of anxiety. Sometimes things will be really intense and uncomfortable. And the goal is not to reduce it, but pay attention to it so you can figure out how to proceed. So my view is, when people practice a mindful acceptance exercise and they do it, you know, daily, let's say 10 to 15 minutes in a calm, neutral setting, it makes it so much easier for them to draw on those skills when they're in a situation that's anxiety provoking. And, you know, then they can maybe navigate the situation a little bit more effectively because they have that non-judgmental awareness.
Well, one suggestion you have in practicing this mindful acceptance exercise, you say do it after waking or at the end of the day. And I would lobby for doing it when you wake up, because so much comes up. And by the end of the day, I would think somebody would be very likely to put that off and say, oh, well, I just don't have time, I'm tired. And so I really think if people, even if they're not a morning person, put that at the beginning of the day to show it has a high priority. That's just my take on that.
Yeah, I agree with you. I sort of look at it that way too, that if this is something that you're unlikely to do, or if you think it's difficult, why not start your day with that, right? You're kind of fresh, ready to go. It's an easy thing to, you know, spend 10 minutes on, and then you get on with things. But what's so interesting is I have a lot of clients who tell me they wake up in the morning and they're so aware of that internal arousal and they find it distressing, and they're not able to pinpoint the cause. They don't understand why they feel that way. So the prospect of doing a mindful acceptance exercise when you know, they feel really wound up, they're experiencing anxiety in those moments, it's not very inviting, I think, to a lot of people, and they prefer to do it at the end of the day. So I guess my take is, whenever you have the time, whenever you have an opportunity to really take it seriously, to really, devote some serious attention to the practice, do it. And it's not as important to pick a particular time of day unless, unless somebody really has a tendency to say, well, I'm just not going to do it. I'll leave it alone. And then they don't develop the skills.
You mentioned in your book that in the United States, about a third of adults will meet the criteria for an anxiety disorder at some point. And I read that because a lot of what you said, I don't feel anxiety in situations where a lot of people do. Mm-hmm. I used to perform in theater, and I remember opening night, a lot of the cast would be anxious. And I wouldn't be, but we're going out there to have fun and help the audience have fun. And I didn't feel anxiety in that situation. And I tried to recall, well, when did I feel anxious? And I remember once in a tennis tournament, I was an older player who was going to be playing a younger, an up-and-coming young woman. And people were saying, okay, is the newcomer going to beat Nancy? And I remember feeling my heart rate increase, and I was breathing. So I remember my physical reaction. I was not breathing hard because they hadn't even started the game yet. But I felt some of these symptoms that would classify that as anxiety. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, well, yeah, that I have experienced anxiety, but for the most part, a lot of these things that you describe didn't pertain to me, mm-hmm. but I can see you see the people who need help with anxiety. So they're the ones that come to you.
That's right. And, and I would argue that, sometimes anxiety creates, maybe a minor challenge on occasion, and sometimes anxiety creates a really big problem. So people vary in the way they experience anxiety and the situations that are anxiety provoking. But I really like your example that, in maybe a kind of a performing arts domain, no problem for you, right? No anxiety. And then, in another area when you're playing, was it tennis?
A tennis tournament.
And then in that case, right, then you did experience that anxiety. And so I think it really highlights that this is such an important concept that, the way we understand a situation, the way we think about the future, the way we think about our ability to cope is so closely related to that experience of anxiety. So let's say, for example, if you were in a tennis tournament and you thought, I don't know who I'm going to be playing against, or I don't know how good the competition is, or I don't know what sort of crowd is going to be here, or I haven't played in a while, or, all of these things, right? That type of thinking suggests that this is a threat. This is something that maybe not dangerous, but it's a challenge. It's something that is potentially quite overwhelming, and I don't know if I'm going to be able to perform well in that context.
And part of that was also others' expectations, because mm-hmm. I had been winning all along, and can I live up to their expectations? Or so part of that too is, and you bring this up in your book often, is this other person going to, and what you fill in the blank there. Now, you also, I like the fact, because we were talking about the fact that this is a personalized reaction to various situations, and you have in your book 4 steps for effective plan for personalizing anxiety management. So you acknowledge the fact that not everybody is anxious in the same situations. So you offer steps for laying out your own personalized anxiety management.
Mm-hmm. That's right, because people vary so much in what's anxiety provoking for them and why anxiety creates problems. So I think it's, I guess I sort of look at it like, the book addresses the foundational elements that are kind of present or that drive anxiety for just about anyone in any kind of situation. So it's sort of a universal way of thinking about anxiety and trying to manage it. And then taking those basic foundational concepts, anybody can say, all right, I'm going to use This idea, for example, cognitive restructuring, I'm going to kind of think about how to understand the situation in a more realistic and useful way. And they can apply it to their very specific concerns, which I think is so important, because obviously we don't want to spend a lot of time trying to address anxiety if a problem just doesn't exist in certain areas of life.
My guest is clinical psychologist Joel Minden, and he has written a book, Show Your Anxiety, Who's Boss? And this is really a guide in the on the title on page. It says, a three-step CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy program to help you reduce anxious thoughts and worry. Since that's on the cover of your book, a three-step program, you outline these three steps in your book. So, Joel, can you tell us, what are those three steps?
Certainly. So, step number one, I think one of the things that I try to point out to people, who have a tough time with anxiety is, first of all, really important to understand what's going on in your mind. What are you thinking about when anxiety is really tough to deal with? And as I suggested earlier, generally when people are anxious, they're thinking about the future and they're overestimating a threat or a challenge and underestimating their ability to cope. So really important for people to understand how they think and how their thoughts directly relate to the emotional response of anxiety. So what tends to happen is, when people do struggle with anxiety, the biases in thinking make it difficult for a person to be objective. So here's a good example. Sometimes people have a lot of anxiety about driving on the freeway. And
now there's one for me. I'll tell you right there. I hadn't thought about that. Oh, yes. That's me right there.
That's a relatable example.
Oh, yeah.
What's interesting about that is sometimes I work with folks and they say, driving's really scary for me. And, I guess the first question I have is, well, are you a good driver? Do you have any driving-related issues? And generally people say, no, objectively, I'm a good driver. I'm actually an excellent driver. But for some reason, once I get in the car, I start to think that I'm going to get in an accident or people are going to cut me off or, something horrible will happen. And
I miss an exit.
Miss an exit. But sometimes it escalates, it gets much more frightening. So, maybe to the point where I'm going to hyperventilate, I might pass out. I might die. I have to pull over to the side of the road. And, so these are the concerns that pop up for people. And so this might be an example of catastrophizing, where instead of thinking about what's likely to occur or what typically occurs, sometimes our minds go to the worst possible outcome. And certainly that would be, an awful thing, right? If we pass out while driving or if we have to be taken to the emergency room because we're not able to finish a drive, pull over to the side of the road and have to call for help. So these are scary things for people, but I think sometimes, I say we, right? Because I think we all do this in some situations. We get so focused on, that worst possible outcome, the catastrophic outcome, that it's really hard to be objective about, what's going on and how should I proceed. So I guess going back to the steps, the three steps, the first step is I really like to help people explore how they tend to think. Are they overestimating threat and underestimating their ability to cope? And then the learning how to respond to these cognitive distortions, or some people call them thinking traps, or I like to call them anxious fictions, because they're kind of these lies that we tell ourselves. But I say, the book has a lot of little catchphrases like this to make it a little more streamlined, but one of the cues is make useful predictions, not anxious fictions. So this involves identifying the anxious fictions, the biased ways of thinking, and then responding with ideas that are probably more realistic, probably more accurate, and certainly more useful in terms of how will I cope. So that's step number one, identify the cognitive elements of anxiety and then find a comeback, a way to respond that's more realistic and useful. Do you want me to go into number two, or were you going to say something about that?
No, let's go on to step two. And I'll remind listeners that this is Joel Minden, and he is outlining his three-step cognitive behavioral therapy program to help reduce anxious thoughts and worry. Okay, so that was number one. Number two in your three-step program.
Yeah, and I guess for the other ones, I'll just kind of use the catchphrase to kind of get it started, maybe a little easier to have that framework. So number two, and I would say this is, you know, perhaps the most important, at least in my mind, the most important aspect of lifelong anxiety management. And this I call take action, demand satisfaction. And what I mean by that is often, as I said earlier, when people struggle with anxiety, they tend to be avoidant. They pull away from situations that they think are going to be too uncomfortable to handle, where they won't be able to function, or they have the concern that they can't function. And that avoidance, it just creates so many problems for people. And avoidance can take so many different forms. So I think we all recognize that idea of avoidance where, let's say, if you're a student and you've got a paper to write, you might avoid getting started because it just seems too difficult and, you know, you're not motivated, not prepared. So we might see avoidance like in the form of procrastination. That happens a lot. But sometimes avoidance is really subtle. Avoidance can be emotional avoidance. So for example, if someone says, I'm so overwhelmed by how anxious I am, I can't go into a social situation unless I have a cocktail, unless I have some drinks, so that I can relax a little bit and feel more comfortable. So that would be sort of a form of avoidance of the emotion itself. I can't tolerate this anxiety and I have to have the drink to make me feel better. Some people avoid with exercise, or they say, you know, when I feel like I'm having a panic attack, I do some breathing exercises. I don't want to suggest that these are bad things to do, but arguably, all of these are forms of avoidance, and that we're trying to distance ourselves from the situations or that make us anxious or just anxiety itself. So the more we attend to anxiety, the more we try to work so hard to reduce it and control it, the more we're taken away from things that we really value. So take action is about taking those steps to work toward those situations that are so important, but difficult. So let's use that driving example, right? If driving is anxiety provoking, and that, you know, and as a result, right, somebody might say, well, I don't drive anymore. I wait for other people to give me a ride, or I just don't go anywhere. I don't visit with family and friends. They might say, well, I really want to prioritize, you know, my relationships, and I want to find a way to get in the car and drive to see somebody that I care about. So here they're thinking about, how do I take action? But the challenge, of course, is that when you take action, when you put yourself in the car or whatever situation, you probably will feel anxious. It's probably going to occur. So I think there are different ways that you can start to take those steps to address anxiety-related concerns that maybe minimize the use of avoidance and other coping strategies like that, and really prioritize your values, getting on with your life, doing the things that are important and meaningful, the things that bring pleasure and a sense of accomplishment. And I think most people with an anxiety disorder, who have extreme distress or dysfunction because of anxiety, they really want to get back to living. They want to have that life satisfaction. So strategy number two is take action, demand satisfaction, start taking those steps. It can be gradual, it can be small, you can plan it out, but take those steps to getting on with your life, to getting back to the things that really matter, and perhaps spend a little less time working so hard to control or reduce anxiety itself.
Well, now you somewhat mentioned in passing breathing, taking deep breath, because there's an entire book now. James Nestor has written a book called Breath, The New Science of a Lost Art. But he mentions that proper breathing can ease anxiety, and he tells us what the right way to breathe is. So you mentioned that somewhat in passing, but do you encourage people to focus on deep breathing, say, or just taking some breaths?
Rarely do I suggest that, and this is the reason why.
That was my impression. That's why I wanted to ask.
Yeah.
So many people.
And I certainly don't want to, kind of send the message out that breathing isn't important. Of course it is. But here's the danger. I think, somebody's, let's say they're about to have a panic attack, or, they feel like they're going to hyperventilate, or just, about to give a presentation or something, right, where the internal arousal is really intense. And so I think we've all heard this message that, those are those times where, the breathing starts to speed up, it's rapid, and you really want to slow it down. You want to take full breaths and the diaphragmatic breathing. And the theory here, of course, is that if there's excessive internal arousal due to anxiety, that the idea here is that the breathing exercises are going to help the individual reduce the anxiety. But the problem with that is often people will try these breathing exercises and they don't have much of an impact. Or if they do have an impact, it's kind of inconsistent. They can't really depend on the breathing exercises to help them every single time. And then they get even more overwhelmed, right? This is all I've got. It's my only tool. And I'm trying to do the deep breathing and I'm still extremely anxious. So sometimes it works, but then it sort of strengthens the idea that if I'm anxious, I have to do something to relax. And the message that I really try to send in this book is, anxiety, as you kind of acknowledged in the beginning of our talk today, anxiety is annoying, it's uncomfortable, it's distracting, but it's tolerable. It's harmless. It's not going to hurt you. It's just an emotion. And the more that we can kind of look at anxiety objectively and say, okay, I see it's there. I wish I didn't have to deal with this right now, but it's okay. I can still handle this. The easier it is to kind of redirect our attention back to the things that we really care about and, get back to taking action to have those satisfying outcomes. So breathing exercises are okay, but I think a lot of people get really dependent on them. And then when they find that the breathing doesn't reduce anxiety enough or it doesn't eliminate it, sometimes people really get so down on themselves. They beat themselves up over this problem. Why do I struggle so much? Why doesn't the breathing work for me? Why can't I get rid of this? And I think my perspective is you don't have to get rid of it. And sometimes anxiety is even useful. It's a nice cue to action. It's much more important for lifelong anxiety management to learn how to relate to anxiety and not focus so much on trying to reduce or eliminate it.
After a break, I'll be back with my guest, clinical psychologist Joel Menden. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Joel Menden, and he has written a book, a guide to reducing anxiety with his three-step cognitive behavioral therapy program. And you were just mentioning breathing and James Nestor in his book about breath, titled just Breath, does say, done properly, it can ease anxiety. And probably if you're in the midst of an anxious attack, you might not breathe properly in his way of thinking. In fact, you make the point, too, that the most useful responses to anxiety are often counterintuitive.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I guess that's sort of what I was saying before, right, that our initial impulse is, what do I do to calm down? How can I get rid of this? Or how do I protect myself by not putting myself in a situation that's going to make me feel so uncomfortable? So that, I guess I just want to say as an aside, so many of the people that I work with who have a tough time with anxiety, they're so high functioning, they're so intelligent, they're so good at problem solving, they're so good at taking action in so many areas of life, but there are certain domains, certain contexts, certain worries that really are difficult to tolerate, to face. And so what happens, I think, for a lot of people is they're so used to being excellent problem solvers, and then they try to deal with the problem of anxiety itself. And anxiety is not very forgiving. If you try to do something to reduce it, often your brain is going to keep sending those signals that, you know, you've identified a threat. You told me that you weren't able to handle this, that you were unprepared to cope. And so I'm going to keep reminding you that this is a threat, that you're in danger and you need to prepare yourself. So trying to use those same tactics, you know, I'll just problem solve, I'll take action. When you're trying to address anxiety itself and not a practical problem, anxiety is just not going to be very forgiving. If anything, it, you know, your body, your mind, they're probably going to fight back. And so that's why a lot of people feel so helpless, so distressed, because they just can't get rid of anxiety. They can't control it like they want to. So the counterintuitive message is, instead of working so hard to address anxiety itself, see if you can change your relationship to anxiety and really direct your time and your energy, your attention to living a life that gives you meaning and purpose.
Well, you just mentioned helpless, and I was thinking back to an incident where I was very anxious, and it was because I was helpless. My plane was late landing in New York. I had a connecting flight to catch, and of course, I'm helpless. I can't do anything about the speed of the airplane or when it's going to land. Mm-hmm. But I remember this was the first time I'd ever flown to Europe and back. And watching my watch and thinking, oh, I'm going to miss my flight. I'm going to miss my flight. I kept repeating, I'm going to miss my flight. And the instant I realized, yeah, I missed it. So I'll just catch another flight. And I felt so stupid after that. I wasted all that anxiety for nothing. Mm-hmm. It was this, this anxiety that you call this fiction, anxious fiction, that it was going to matter if I missed the flight. It was an anxious fiction. I don't know if you would put that label on it, but that seems that to me what it was.
Yeah, and I think that's such a great example, because I think we all have experiences like that where we're so worried. We have all these concerns that, you know, something bad's going to happen, and I can't shake this, and I wish I could do something. I wish I had more control over the situation. And when we don't, when there's really nothing that we can do, we're just kind of stuck and we have to wait, then it's so easy to get invested in that inner experience, once again, to get wrapped up in, you know, I'll never get home, or I'll have to, you know, I'll have to pay more to get another flight, or whatever is going through your mind, and getting wrapped up in the internal arousal and, you know, the urge to find some sort of solution when there isn't one. And then, like you said, right, then we actually experience the setback. You missed the flight, you have to take a different one. And it's like, oh, okay, this is something that I think I can handle. You know, I have to deal with this. And it's much more straightforward. It's clear cut, and so now I'm ready to move forward. So that's one of the reasons why, you know, step one involves identifying the anxious fictions, those patterns of thinking that kind of create that initial problem of anxiety. Because at least when you're feeling that way, if you can attend to those thoughts, you can sort of pinpoint the cause or the issue that is driving anxiety, and from there it makes it a lot easier to figure out how to respond.
Clinical psychologist Joel Minden outlining his three steps in a program to help reduce anxious thoughts and worry. So we've covered step one, step two. What about step three, Joel?
Step three is essentially, and we've talked about this already, kind of started out with this, but this is where we might learn how to relate differently to anxiety itself. So in the first two steps, you know, we have the capacity to demonstrate some personal control by changing the way we think, or by doing something to get our needs met, or to work through an emotional challenge so that we can do something we really care about. But the problem with this is no matter how much you prepare, no matter how much you try to correct your thinking, no matter how much you take action, anxiety is going to be there. And so sometimes people, they really struggle with anxiety because it's not that there's a practical problem that concerns them. It's the uncertainty of the future that's frightening. So, for example, you know, uncertainty, sometimes people get kind of caught up on existential concerns, like, you know, will I be alone forever? Or when will I die? Or is there an afterlife? Or, you know, all of these things that we can't answer. And that's frightening for people. I want the answer. I want to have some control. I want to have some influence over what happens here. Or another example of an anxiety-provoking concern would be an intrusive thought. Like, for example, somebody's going hiking, and I think we've all had kind of strange thoughts like this. Like, you're on a hike, and then you kind of look over the edge, right? You're on this big hill or mountain, and then you kind of have this image of, you know, of jumping off. And sometimes people, they think, you know, what's going on with me? The fact that I thought about, you know, jumping off this mountain or something and doing something really dangerous, does that indicate that unconsciously I have a death wish, or there's something wrong with me? Is this a disturbance? And so then, you know, again, you can't answer that question. Although I think most of us know, right, that we don't really want to do that. It's just kind of an odd kind of image or idea that pops into mind. But anyway, my point here is that, you know, even with great intentions and with taking action in a cognitive or a behavioral domain, we're often left with some residual. There's going to be anxiety that's persistent. It doesn't respond to the other methods. And so that's where I think it's important to learn how to accept anxiety as just an authentic emotional experience, and then redirect. Accept and redirect is the cue. It's a mantra that I like so much. And that goes back to the mindful acceptance work. I see the anxiety. I know it's there. There's nothing I can really do about it. I can't create or I can't establish greater certainty in this moment. And that's frustrating for me, but I can allow that authentic emotional reaction to exist. I accept it. And now I'm going to redirect my attention to whatever is more meaningful in the moment. So accept and redirect.
Well, one suggestion that you have, and I haven't done it regularly, but the one time I did, I found it helpful. And you suggest keeping a notebook or a thought record as a way of tracking anxious fictions. And I remember back when there was one time when I had time to record dreams, and I haven't done it before since. But if I thought back to one dream I had one morning, okay, I had that dream. And then maybe a couple of days later, well, I had that dream. And without recording it, it wasn't until I read back over them that I saw a pattern. And I realized, this is something I'm anxious about, but I would not have known had I not written it down. And I thought of this when I read about Corey, your law student, because she was anxious after she finished law school. For me, I was going to enter law school, and I would have these dreams, something like a bridge. In other words, I was crossing over this. And so I didn't realize I was anxious about starting law school until I wrote these things down in a notebook. Mm-hmm. And so I can see why you would encourage people to keep track of these anxious fictions, as you call them. Do you have success with that, or are people resistant to writing these down, Joel?
Yeah, you're right on there. I think a lot of people are resistant. They don't like writing stuff down, and you know, they sort of feel, and this is one of, because sometimes this is a knock on CBT. A lot of people say, I go to CBT or a CBT therapist, and I have all this homework. I feel like I'm in school, these worksheets. And personally, I think, you know, there's a lot of value in writing things down. You don't have to, you know, fill out endless worksheets to get to the bottom of a concern. But even if you just
I wouldn't have seen that pattern had I not written it down. I would just thought these were isolated things until I had it written down and looked at it and said,
That's right. And, you know, it's so amazing that something as simple as, and a lot of people, by the way, as an aside, a lot of people say, well, I don't have to write it down. I'm so aware of how anxious I am. What good is it going to do me to put it down on paper? But what I find again and again is that often when people, when they start to think about an upcoming challenge, their thinking becomes really vague, very generalized, like, this is going to be so bad. And my question, you know, of course, the follow-up is, well, what specifically is going to be so bad? And sometimes people are stumped, right? They think, I've been worrying about this event so much, I've got so many ideas, but when I ask them directly, what's the very specific issue that you think you might face or you might have to work through, sometimes it's tough for people to identify. So when you write things down, you sort of take those ambiguous ideas that are kind of bouncing around in your mind, especially people who have a tendency to worry, they go from one thought to the next. Really helpful to just say, okay, step by step, I'm going to write all of my concerns down. And when you do that, it helps you clarify the concern and it helps you problem solve. And kind of getting back to the three strategies in my book, when you write these concerns down, you can identify those areas in which it might be helpful to challenge the anxious fictions with the more useful ideas. You can identify some areas in which you want to start to take action, you want to start moving towards some meaningful goals. And then you can also identify some areas where perhaps practicing basic acceptance is going to pay off, where you can just kind of acknowledge that this is the emotional experience I'm dealing with in this moment. And I want to give myself a break. I want to be patient with myself and just allow that to be there. So writing stuff down, it brings so much clarity to the thinking. It makes it so much easier to figure out what to do next. And I'm a big fan of writing things down. And I recognize that's not a comfortable process for a lot of people, but I think it really makes a big difference in terms of getting the most out of tactics like those that I present in the book.
You know, I think it might also help with something, another point that you make, that if you're just thinking about something, you might not think in a balanced way. For example, if I'm reflecting on the past, I would tend to focus on what did not work and kind of ignore what worked. So perhaps if you write it down, you would give equal attention to what worked and what didn't work.
That's true. And I think, you know, that's where... you know, there's more to it. Sometimes I talk with clients and they say, oh, I do a lot of journaling, a lot of writing. And I ask, what's your method? What's your process? And they say, I just write stuff down, you know, that seems important. And so I think if you do it that way, there's not going to be a lot of balance to the thinking. But, you know, like you're talking about, if you give yourself the opportunity to think about, well, I'm so focused on a setback of the past, and I think that's going to happen again in the future. When you write it down, you might remind yourself, well, I also want to kind of remember those instances in which I didn't struggle or where I was able to handle a situation effectively and I didn't think that I would be able to. So that's where you can intentionally create some balance to your thinking by taking that time to sort of explore events from the past or what you know about an upcoming challenge or what you've done to cope previously or what you think might be helpful in the future. You just map it all out. And I think, you know, the more balance and more specificity that you can bring to your thinking, the better in terms of lifelong anxiety management.
My guest has been Joel Minden. He's a clinical psychologist who's written the book, Show Your Anxiety Who's Boss, a three-step CBT program to help you reduce anxious thoughts and worry. And I would like to just conclude with a couple of points you make, Joel. You tell us that anxiety is a normal part of the human experience and that anxiety is natural and at times even useful. Mm-hmm. So thank you for writing this book, Joel.
Thank you, Nancy.
Again, my guest has been clinical psychologist Joel Minden. His book, Show Your Anxiety Who's Boss.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.